Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Demons and Deception, Part 3. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight.
Diabolical forces are formidable. These forces are eternal and they exist today. The fairy tale is true. The devil exists. God exists. And for us, as a people, our destiny hinges upon which one we elect to follow. Ed Warren.
In episodes 1 and 2, we discussed the DeFeo family, a seemingly normal, white, middle-class American family from Amityville in Long Island. We spoke about how, beneath the surface, there were deep problems. Problems which built up like a frog on a hot plate over time. Mob ties, hard drugs, volatile tempers, physical and mental abuse, and underlying psychological problems all contributed to an explosive series of murders in November of 1974. 6 murders. When the eldest son in the family, Ronnie Jr., brutally killed his parents and 4 siblings, in a drug-fueled haze of hatred and aggression, it caused a ripple like nothing had ever done before in the quiet and serene seaside town. It was enough for many in the community to have to come to terms with, to contemplate and heal from. But sadly, this was only the start. The word Amityville would soon become synonymous with circus, crazy, and astonishing. And tonight we are going to take a deeper look at this astonishing story. On December the 4th, 1975, Ronnie DeFeo Jr., known to many in the town of Amityville as Butch, was sentenced to 6 life sentences for the murder of his family members. Then, 2.5 weeks later, the next chapter began. Okay, so this story is very complicated. So let's start carefully, shall we? I think the best way of doing so is by quoting the author, Jay Anson, who wrote the internationally best-selling book titled The Amityville Horror. So let's get into it. Quote.
On February 5th, 1976, the 10 o'clock news on New York's Channel 5 announced it was doing a series on people who claimed to have extrasensory powers. The program cut to reporter Steve Bauman investigating an allegedly haunted house in Amityville, Long Island. Bauman said that on November 13th, 1974, a large colonial house at 112 Ocean Avenue had been the scene of a mass murder. 24-year-old Ronald DeFeo had taken a high-powered rifle and methodically shot to death his parents, 2 brothers, and 2 sisters. DeFeo had subsequently been sentenced to life imprisonment. 2 months ago, the report continued, the house was sold for $80,000 to a couple named George and Kathleen Lutz. The The Lutzes had been aware of the killings, but not being superstitious, they had felt the house would be perfect for themselves and their three children. They moved in on December 18th. Shortly thereafter, Bauman said they had become aware that the place was inhabited by some psychic force and that they feared for their lives. They talked of feeling the presence of some energy inside, some unnatural evil that grew stronger each day they remained. 4 weeks after they moved in, the Lutzes abandoned the house, taking only a few changes of clothes. At present, they were staying with friends in an undisclosed location, but before they left, Channel 5 stated, their predicament had become known in the area. They had consulted the police and a local priest, as well as a psychic research group. They reportedly told of strange voices seeming to come from within themselves, of a power which actually lifted Mrs. Lutz off her feet toward a closet behind which was a room not noted on any blueprints. Reporter Steve Bauman had heard of their claims. After doing some background research on the house, he discovered that tragedy had struck nearly every family inhabiting the place, as well as an earlier house built on the same site. The Channel 5 announcer went on to say that William Weber, the attorney representing Ronald DeFeo, had commissioned studies hoping to prove that some force influenced the behavior of anyone living at 112 Ocean Avenue. Weber claimed this force may be of natural origin and felt it might be the evidence he needed to win his client a new trial. On camera, Weber said he was aware that certain houses could be built or constructed in a certain manner so as to create some sort of electrical currents through some rooms based on the physical structure of the house. Again, the scientists said they are investigating that to rule that out. And after they rule out all reasonable or scientific explanation, then it's going to be referred over to another group at Duke University, who will delve into the psychic aspects of the case. The report concluded by saying that the Catholic Church was also involved. Channel 5 stated that two emissaries from the Vatican had arrived in Amityville in December and were reported to have told the Lutzes to leave their home immediately. Now the Church's Council of Miracles is studying the case, and its report is that indeed 112 Ocean Avenue is possessed of some spirits beyond current human knowledge. 2 weeks after the telecast, George and Kathy Lutz held a press conference in attorney William Weber's office. The DeFeo lawyer had met the couple 3 weeks before through mutual friends. George Lutz stated to reporters that he would not spend another night in the house, but he was not planning to sell 112 Ocean Avenue just then. He was also awaiting the results of some scientific tests to be conducted by parapsychologists and other sensitive professional researchers of occult phenomena. At that point in time, the Lutzes cut off all communication with the media, feeling that too much was being overstated and exaggerated. It is only now that their whole story is being told. On December 18th, 1975, George and Kathy Lutz moved into 112 Ocean Avenue. 28 days later, they fled in terror.
For clarity, the events described within the Amityville Horror and the events that actually occurred in so-called real life are two very different and separate things. In tonight's episode, I'm going to quote and utilize eyewitness accounts from those individuals who are actually present at the time and actually involved in the events described. I think it's important to emphasize this. Those individuals being Danny Lutz, Christopher Quarantino, formerly Lutz, Father Ralph Pecoraro, Carol Soviero, Joe Vetter, Gloria Gangitano, Tommy Maher, and archive interviews from George and Kathy Lutz themselves. All I ask from you is that you approach the next 60 minutes with an open mind and reserve judgment until the end of this episode. We'll present you with all the facts, dispel the myths and rumors, and allow you to arrive at your own conclusions. Author J. Anson's book described the house at 112 Ocean Avenue as being empty for 13 months after the DeFeo murders. This is entirely true. Michael Brigante and his wife Angelina repainted the house white and cleaned it up to prepare it for sale. They put it on the market for $100,000. In December 1975, George and Kathy Lutz purchased the house. Even though it was listed for $100,000, the Lutzes offered $80,000 and it was accepted. The Brigantes wanted a quick sale to get rid of the property and the painful memories attached to it. George Lutz was a former Marine who had served in Vietnam. After he left the military, he inherited a surveillance business that his grandfather had started. Kathy was a waitress. She had been married before, but got divorced in 1973. She had three children from her first marriage, Daniel, who was 9, Christopher, who was 7, and Melissa, aged 5. They also had a crossbreed Malamute Labrador dog called Harry. George and Kathy married in July 1975. They had met when George came into the diner where Kathy worked. George asked Kathy out a few times, but she always declined. But one evening, after her shift had ended, her car wouldn't start, and she began to walk home. But George came to the rescue and gave her a lift on his Harley Davidson motorcycle. George was a huge biker fan and had two Harleys, a standard two-wheel chopper, and a three-wheel Harley trike with a petrol tank shaped like a coffin. After that ride home, George and Kathy were both smitten kittens. When they first met, both George and Kathy had their own homes. Initially, Kathy sold her house for $40,000, and both her and her children moved into George's apartment. But space quickly became an issue, so they started to look for a home with more space. So George sold his place too. The Lutzes had a mutual friend in common with the late DeFeo family who suggested they take a look at the Ocean Avenue property. The neighborhood would have been way out of their price range, but after their friend suggested they should take a look anyway, they both thought it wouldn't hurt to check the place out. The house was on the market for $100,000, as I said. George and Kathy offered $80,000 and the offer was accepted. And with that, the Lutzes moved into 112 Ocean Avenue early on the morning of December 18th, 1975. They couldn't believe that they had found such an incredible property for such a bargain. The house was easily worth around $125,000, but given its recent history, they understood why they got such a great deal. George and Kathy didn't think the history of the house would be a problem for them or their children.
The realtor told us after we'd toured the house, this is the house the DeFeos were murdered in, the news stories that had been a year earlier. We talked about it at length as a family. We asked the kids, look, you're going to have the same bedrooms that these kids had and they were killed here. Is that going to be a problem? They were all fine with it. It wasn't a snap decision by any means.
In the summer of 1973, George met Joe Vetter at a bar. Vetter was a fellow biker, and the two became fast friends. George was always a loner up until this point, but him and Joe really hit it off, and Joe introduced George to his other friends, a biker gang based out of Long Island. The group quickly took to George, and George enjoyed spending time with like-minded friends too. Now, whenever this story is talked about, everyone, and I mean literally everyone, just regurgitates the exact same cut-and-paste story of the Amityville Horror that they just took from another website. Ultimately, this is why so many falsities around this case exist. So let's be clear. Jay Anson's book, published in 1977, is a work of fiction. Yes, it was marketed as a true story, but it wasn't. Jay Anson confirmed this. George and Kathy Lutz confirmed this. Daniel Lutz confirmed this. And Christopher Quarantino, formerly Lutz, has also confirmed this. Unfortunately, because the book was marketed as a quote-unquote true story, most people think that this is what the Lutzes peddled as fact. It isn't. Bear with me. I'll clarify. In 1979, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Pictures released The Amityville Horror, starring James Brolin and Margot Kidder. The movie was based on the story that Jay Anson had written. It grossed, adjusted for inflation, $310 million at the worldwide box office. It was a huge hit, despite being panned by critics. It was the second high-grossing movie of 1979, surpassed only by the Academy Award-winning Kramer vs. Kramer. It was a global movie phenomenon at a time when the public were very hungry for all things occult, thanks to The Exorcist's popularity 5 years prior. Both the Amityville Horror book and the Amityville Horror movie were massively popular. The book was an international bestseller, and the movie, as I said, was the second biggest movie of the year. Both the book and movie were marketed as quote-unquote a true story. To be clear, neither are, as confirmed by the writer and those involved. In fact, the book had taken significant liberties with what the Lutzes had experienced in the Ocean Avenue house, and the movie had taken even further liberties by embellishing what was portrayed in the book even further for the big screen. Due to the true story marketing, many people have referred to the Amityville Horror as a hoax and a fake money-making scheme. The Lutzes helped promote the book and movie upon their releases because they were paid handsomely for it. But I think this is where the confusion originated. In promoting the movie, the Lutzes were interviewed on television, radio, and in the print media, and they confirmed, yes, what happened to us was real. We experienced significant paranormal phenomenon at the Amityville house. But what they experienced was not what was in the book. What the Lutz family experienced was an entirely different series of events. Events that George and Kathy swore by until their deaths, and two of the three Lutz children, Danny and Christopher, still swear by to this very day. Melissa, the youngest child, refuses to talk about what happened within the house and remains out of the public eye. If you are truly interested in what happened at 112 Ocean Avenue in December and January of 1975, don't read Jay Anson's book and don't watch the 1979 movie of the same name, or the 2005 remake, also with the same name. Instead, listen on, and we will share the real account of the Amityville Horror from the words and accounts of those who were there. On a side note, if you want to read a pretty good horror book or watch a classic 70s horror movie, then definitely check out the book and movie. Just understand that they are purely entertainment. In July 1975, George Lutz, Joe Vetter, and the motorbike gang attended the Laconia Bike Weekend at Weirs Beach, New Hampshire. Bikers from all over the state congregated at the event. Excitement, camaraderie, merriment, and the freedom of the open road. At this time, George was also heavily into transcendental meditation, something he would later get Kathy heavily involved in too. He insisted upon stopping regularly to meditate while on the way to and from the bike rally. It was something the other guys joked and ribbed George for, but it was also the 1970s, so it wasn't that out of the norm, given the popularity of the counterculture at the time. Before they set off home after their weekend at Weirs Beach, Vetter informed George that his brother-in-law had a house and a museum in Bayshore, Long Island, and he might like to stop by on their way home. His brother-in-law was Dr. Raymond Buckland, the well-known, renowned, and popular British anthropologist and white witch who had brought the Wiccan religion to the United States from the UK at the end of the 1960s. The museum that Buckland operated displayed occult items relating to Wicca, witchcraft, magic, and demonology. This was a subject that George was quietly very interested in, and he jumped at the chance to stop by the museum. So they did. Vetter later said that George spent a long time in the museum and a significant amount of time conversing with Buckland that day. Long after the other bikers had left and headed off, George stayed behind and spent the day in the company of the White Witch. As it turns out, George had visited the museum previously, although didn't indicate this to Vetter at the time. As I said, George had a vested interest in the occult, but he kept it very quiet. Whilst the counterculture was very popular and in the open at this time, witchcraft and the occult, and in particular Wiccan practices, were still looked upon unfavorably by many and seen as heathen or devilish practices. This was just on the cusp of the satanic panic striking the United States, so you can understand why George didn't flaunt his interest in the subject. Remember this. When George and Kathy came to view the house on Ocean Avenue, they were pretty burnt out with the process. They had viewed around 50 properties over the previous 6 months, so that, coupled with the bargain they got on the 4,000 square foot home in an affluent neighborhood with a boathouse and in-ground heated pool, seemed almost too good to be true. Naysayers online often say that George and Kathy couldn't afford the house. But this isn't true at all. George owned a successful business, and him and Kathy had both sold previous properties. They were financially comfortable when they moved into Ocean Avenue. The realtor showing them the house stated, quote, "I don't know if I should tell you now or after, but you've seen the house, so this was the house that the DeFeo murders took place in," unquote. It had been in the newspapers the year before, and again recently due to the trial and sentencing of the perpetrator. Some sources state that George and Kathy weren't aware of what had happened in the house. But this is untrue. They both knew the history of the house when they came to view it. They had heard about the house from a friend who actually knew the DeFeo family. So they were indirectly linked. When George and Kathy viewed the house, their close friend Carol Soviero joined them. They had asked her to come and take photographs of the property while they looked around, something they could view later and make a decision as to whether they would buy it from. Carol has said that she indicated to George and Kathy while they were walking around the house that there was a strange presence to the place. She felt uneasy in the house and sensed something was off. George showed Carol the bullet holes that still remained in the woodwork in some of the rooms and laughed with Carol, saying that he didn't feel anything and was more than comfortable buying the place after what had happened there. Still, Carol thought, it was worth getting the house blessed before they moved in. George had grown up a Methodist, and Kathy was a non-practicing Catholic. They considered what energy the house might possess, and took on board what Carol had said to them. So they asked a Catholic priest by the name of Father Ralph Pegoraro, a lawyer, judge of the Catholic court, and psychotherapist who lived at the local Sacred Heart Rectory. They asked Pegoraro if he would bless the house for them, and he agreed. Now, the role of Father Pegoraro has been given a significant amount of attention in the years since the haunting happened. According to George and Kathy Lutz, Father Pegoraro had been asked to bless the house on the day they moved into the property. Father Pegoraro obliged, and in the early afternoon of December the 18th, he arrived at the Ocean Avenue house. It was a Thursday. The weather was clear but cold, around 34 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1 degree Celsius on that particular day. There was a full moon that night, a slight breeze in the air, and spots of sleet. It was very much a winter's day. According to the Lutz family and Father Pecoraro, the following allegedly then occurred. Father Pecoraro adorned himself with his stole and gathered his religious items from his car. He entered the house and began to conduct the ritual of blessing. Father Pecoraro flicked the first drops of holy water and began to speak the blessing prayer. The Holy Father then heard a deep, guttural, angry, disembodied male voice loudly shout, "Get out!" The priest continued with the holy blessing before he was slapped across the face by an invisible force. This occurred when he entered what was Mark and John Matthew DeFeo's bedroom. Father Pecoraro left the house and did not speak to George or Kathy about what he had heard or felt. AmityvilleMurders.com, which is the website owned and operated by Rook Osuna, the author I spoke about in my previous episode, the author who wrote the book about the DeFeo murders, essentially calling for the case to be reopened, well, on his website he has written that Father Pecoraro's involvement in the haunting was essentially a fabrication. Nothing more than a phone call took place between him and the Lutzes, he says. Well, this, again, is entirely incorrect. Father Pecoraro did visit the house on December the 18th, 1975, the day the Lutzes moved in. It was purposely arranged that way by Kathy, In 1979, he described his experience while blessing the Amityville house during a television interview. We have that clip here. This is Father Pecoraro in his own words.
I was blessing the sewing room. It was cold. It was really cold in there. And I thought, gee, this is peculiar. Because it was a lovely day out. And it was winter, yes, but it didn't account for that kind of coldness. I also sprinkling holy water. And I heard a rather deep voice behind me say, "Get out." It seemed so directed toward me that I was really quite startled. I felt a slap at one point on the face. I felt somebody slap me, and there was nobody there.
This interview was given to the popular and one of my personal favorite paranormal shows, titled In Search Of. An absolute classic. Rest in peace, Leonard Nimoy. Following the blessing of the house, what happened next would be the subject of intense scrutiny and ridicule over the following years and decades. Initially, members of the family felt random cold spots around the house. You could be walking through a warm, fully heated room one minute, then there would be a specific part of the room where things were ice cold. You could stand there and see your breath in the freezing air, then take 3 steps forward and you would be really warm again, George said. The cold spots moved around and occurred all over the house. In addition to the random cold spots, were foul and horrible smells, which appeared and vanished at random throughout the house. Odors of excrement and rotting flesh would spring up without provocation or cause, then subside again, just as quickly as they appeared. The family could never find a source for the stench. During the first night, sleeping in his new home, George suddenly awoke at 3:15 a.m. This would become a regular, nightly routine during his time there. But George couldn't control it. No matter how hard he tried, and how much he didn't want to, at exactly 3:15 a.m. each night, he would awake. He claimed that his nightly awakenings also came with an obsessive need to go out and check the boathouse. He knew there was nothing to check on, and even thought to himself, "I don't want to go see." But still, an urgent need drove him to walk out to the boathouse every night. It became a strange and bizarre compulsion, George said. Further developments occurred at night in the house, when various members of the family were awakened by what sounded like a loud knocking on walls and doors, building up to doors opening and slamming shut of their own volition. George, Kathy, and the children all experienced it independently, and all would say that they could not establish where the knocking was originating, yet it happened all over the house. George said he heard other sounds too. One was said to be akin to a radio that was not quite tuned to a station that seemed to be featuring a German Umpa band revving up to play but not quite getting there. In the first week of living in the house, the Lutzes invited over a number of friends for a housewarming party. Amongst those invited was Carol Soviero and her husband. You'll recall that Carol already felt unsettled by the house from when she accompanied the Lutzes to view the place. Upon arrival at the house, Carol got out of her car along with her husband and began to feel a little uneasy, sick to her stomach. With each step she took towards the house, she said, she felt more and more sick until eventually she vomited wildly and could hardly control herself. She threw up the contents of her stomach and then bile, copious amounts of bile, and had to return home. Carol never got as far as the front door. She was completely fine by the time she returned home, she recalls. A week later, at Christmas, Carol again visited the Lutzes, who were hosting friends for the festive period. Carol once again became violently sick when she approached the house. She was unable to go to the house, she has stated over the years. It felt like the house would not let her enter. Whilst this is pretty disgusting, yet intriguing, this, you might say, is all coincidence. Maybe either it was just something she had eaten twice. Maybe it was travel sickness from her 30-minute car ride from Brooklyn to the house, even though she had never suffered with travel sickness before or after. Maybe it was just a stomach bug that happened to hit her at that moment and then ease as she got home. Twice. Who knows? Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt this episode. We'll get right back into it in just a second. I just want to remind you all that we have a Patreon. Over there, you can get access to additional episodes, investigation research, articles, blogs, and a bunch of other stuff. It costs just $2 a month, which is an insane bargain and less than the cost of a cup of coffee. You get so much for that price, not to mention you'll be helping us out too. If you want to join us over there, head across to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We hope to see you guys there. Now, back to the show. But all this occurred at the same time that uncanny events were unfolding within the house for the Lutz family. Kathy and George Lutz were practitioners of transcendental meditation. It's something that George had introduced Kathy to after they had met. George, however, had been into the Eastern art for a number of years prior. Christopher Lutz has a lot to say about George's meditation practices, but we'll touch on that in a short while. On the morning of the housewarming party, Kathy was rushing around preparing the house for guests, making food, ensuring there was plenty of seating, prepping the drinks and other accoutrements, as you might for a 70s party. Anyway, Kathy was pretty stressed and took time out to reset herself, to relax and chill out before the guests arrived. She sat on the floor of the living room in front of the fire and began her meditation process. Eyes closed, legs crossed, hands upturned and resting on her knees. Whilst George and Kathy were open about their transcendental meditation rituals, even discussing them on national television the following year while discussing their experiences at Ocean Avenue, what they incorrectly explained was that they actually practiced rituals considered to be spiritual meditation. They meditated and called upon spirits to help them, guide them, and enter them to influence their lives positively. This is a common Eastern practice, and many who follow these techniques and ancient habits may call upon spirits such as Freya, the Norse goddess who will guide you to embrace your sexuality and the cycles of life and death. Ganesha, the elephant-headed deity, to guide you to generosity, wisdom and clarity. Or Kuan Yin, the bodhisattva of compassion, who can open your heart to show mercy to others or your inner self. These are Eastern influenced, but others choose to call upon archangels, past loved ones, or even gods. George and Kathy didn't use any of these in their spirit meditation, however. On that Saturday afternoon, as Kathy began to relax and call into her spirits, something grabbed her arm. Kathy abruptly opened her eyes and stood up. There was no one else there. The house was empty. Whoever had grabbed her arm, whatever had grabbed her arm, Kathy thought, was a woman, or at least feminine. She could feel it in her touch. The following day was a Sunday. Kathy was preparing breakfast for the family, pancakes and bacon. Danny and Christopher had cereal and orange juice. Melissa, or Missy as her family called her, was 5 years old and a sweet and inquisitive little girl. Missy came bounding into the kitchen with her cuddly rabbit, which she took everywhere, and asked Kathy innocently, "Mommy, do angels talk?" "What do you mean?" Kathy asked, only half paying attention. "Someone talks to me and I answer," Missy replied. At the time, Kathy thought this was innocent enough, as did George, who was sitting in the breakfast nook. Kids have active imaginations and imaginary friends, right? But over the next few days, Kathy, George, and Christopher all noticed Missy engaging in a conversation with persons unknown. She was having a half conversation, Kathy later said, asking questions and receiving replies that we couldn't hear. Missy eventually revealed that she had a number of friends in the house. A young boy who she spoke to, an angel, and her best friend, a pig who she named Jody. They all talked to her and told her things, asked her things. Kathy said, on one particular occasion that upset her, she was walking past Missy's room putting away clean clothes from the washing, and she could hear Missy laughing and talking. Kathy gently pushed open Missy's bedroom door and saw her sat on the edge of her bed talking to someone that wasn't there. But Kathy said, the rocking chair that Missy was facing was rocking back and forth, with nobody in it. Kathy told George about this, and later George asked Missy where Jody was. He's outside the window, Missy replied. So George went outside to see if he could see her, but he couldn't, of course. But what he did see, leading from beneath the window of the living room and out past the boathouse to the edge of the water, were hoofed footprints. George followed them and stated that whatever made the footprints had walked into the water, as there was no return prints. Every night at 3:15 a.m., George would awake and wander to the boathouse, then around the house. His whole demeanor changed, the family noticed. George stopped going to work, stopped bathing and practicing personal care. He spent most days sat in front of the fire, wrapped in a blanket, trying to keep warm. The children avoided him as his temper, negativity, and whole presence dipped. George's eyes became sunken. He lost weight and was perpetually angry. Danny and Christopher became agitated too. They couldn't settle in the house and they became argumentative and quarrelsome when their relationship had always been so positive. Danny became an agitator and would pick at Chris, who was 2 years younger than him. Christopher has since recalled how after school, shortly after they moved into the house, Danny locked him in a closet in their bedroom. It was a huge walk-in closet, Chris recalled. He was stuck in there for ages and Danny wouldn't let him out. Christopher said he gave up trying to push at the door and scream because Danny wasn't letting him out. So he sat down in the dark on the closet floor. But he could hear a quiet hissing, he thought. Then, all of a sudden, Christopher was grabbed around the waist by two strong arms and pulled back. Chris leapt up and pulled away, screaming and banging on the door. Danny knew this was a different sound to Christopher's screaming. He heard the panic and fright, and he knew it was real, so he let go of the door, and Chris came flying out, bawling his eyes out. The closet was empty. That closet was an interesting place for Christopher while he lived there. He shared the room with his brother, but he spent more time in that room than Danny did. Chris had a drawstring cotton bag that he hung on a hook on the backside of the closet. It was a bag that he took to school. The hook, however, under the weight of the bag, pulled away a piece of the wooden paneling in the closet, and Chris found a hidden pocket back there. It has clearly been used by someone in the past, Chris thought. There were two large plastic bags in there, so he pulled them both out. They were full of tablets, hundreds of them. Christopher was 7. He had no idea what they were, so he took the bags to George, who duly took them from him and made sure there was nothing else hidden in the compartment. That was the last Christopher saw of the pills, he said. In a 2021 interview, Christopher admitted that he asked George years later if he remembered when he gave him the bag of pills. By now it was around the year 2000. Chris was around 30 years old and looking after his mother Kathy, who was sick with emphysema and wheelchair bound. George said that he was really surprised that he remembered that incident as he was so young. George told him that the bags contained around 300 quaaludes. He suspected they were hidden there by Ronnie DeFeo when he lived in the house. Christopher asked him what he did with those pills, but George said he couldn't remember. Whilst George was wandering the house each night, obsessing over the boathouse and staring into the fire, Kathy was enduring nightly vivid and detailed nightmares about the DeFeo murders. The murders played out in her dreams step by step, Kathy said. She could see it as if she was inside the head of Ronnie DeFeo. George actually contacted the police to inquire about the murders and he shared some of the details that Kathy was seeing in her dreams. The police were startled at the information that she knew, given how the details she saw had never been released to the public. The Lutzes were beginning to despair. It was the dead of winter and the temperature was freezing, but the thing that the haunting of the house on Ocean Avenue is most known for is actually true, sworn as such by George and Kathy, but also by Christopher and Danny. Flies. There were hundreds and hundreds of flies which would appear in certain rooms, the rooms where the murders had occurred. No matter how many the family killed, there would remain hundreds buzzing around, though they would also abruptly vanish or dissipate. More often than not, this would occur when they went into what they called the sewing room. It had been the bedroom of Mark and John Matthew DeFeo prior to the Lutz family moving in. You see, the thing that makes me take note of what happened in the Amityville house isn't just what George and Kathy claimed to happen, although I do believe them, but it's that of Christopher and Danny Lutz. They have since come forward and spoken about the events in that house in the years since. You see, neither Chris or Danny had a positive relationship with George, their stepfather, as the years went on, and neither have a nice word to say about George to this day. Both boys claim that George was abusive physically and mentally, and that due to George being a black belt in jiu-jitsu, they felt he was difficult to fight back against. Laura DeDeo, who was a television anchor for Channel 5 in New York, got to know the family well at this time due to her interest in the family haunting. She said in a 2022 interview that back then Danny would glare at George, the hatred worn on his face for all to see. Danny eventually left the Lutz home when he was 14 and lived on the streets in Nevada for a while. He found his own way in life and now owns a car repair shop and has a daughter of his own. Christopher left home at 16 and joined the US Army, serving for a number of years in the 10th Mountain Division and seeing active duty in Operation Desert Storm. He left the military to look after his ailing mother and these days works as an entrepreneur. Both boys owe nothing to George and would happily call him out on his failings. They have over the years and speak with hostility about him. So when they are both firmly adamant that the haunting at 112 Ocean Avenue was genuine and very, very real, I think I believe them. Because neither have made any money from what happened to their family. And if they could say it was all a hoax and destroy George, then they would. But they haven't. Because they can't. Both continue to deal with the trauma of Amityville to this day. Christopher recalls an occasion where after school one afternoon, he was laying on his bed with just him and his brother home alone in the house, when he saw a black mass walking down the hall outside his bedroom toward him. The mass had no legs, yet he could hear it breathing. "What we saw and went through in that house was no hoax," Christopher says. "I still don't like talking about it to this day." The thing is, so many people call out the Lutzes and it's generally accepted to be a fake story, all concocted for money. But this accusation of fakery can all be traced back to one person. William Weber. Weber was the defense attorney for Ronald DeFeo. DeFeo was up for sentencing after his trial at the same time the Lutzes were going through literal hell in his former home. So Weber contacted the Lutzes and asked them to meet with him at his office. When George and Kathy did, they stated that Weber had a contract for them, a book deal, where he would write a concocted horror story, advertise it as true, the Lutzes would go along with it and get 12% of the profits, Ronnie DeFeo would get 5%, but would also get to utilize the defense that he was possessed by the devil when he committed the murders, and Weber's book and the Lutzes' claims would support this. The Lutzes didn't go for this, however. They felt they had real and genuine experiences which they didn't want to sell to Weber, who was going to add a load of fakery to the story to help support a murderer. George and Kathy walked away, following which Weber claimed on national television and repeated the same claims in the years since then that George, him and Kathy created the Amityville haunting story over several bottles of wine. George, however, claims that Weber is lashing out because they walked away from his deal and eventually signed their own, more lucrative book deal leaving him out in the cold. In fact, Weber's very loud claims of a hoax against George and Kathy were also welcomed by the people of Amityville. The quiet and affluent town wanted nothing to do with the notoriety of a gruesome murder and a supposed haunting, and the locals hated the attention it brought on their once peaceful town. So many locals echoed Weber's claims of the haunting being a hoax. The local town also refused to allow the sale of the Amityville Horror book or show the Amityville Horror movie when they were released too. Locals were aggressively unwelcoming to visitors who came to gawk at the house. I have personally visited the house on a number of occasions, and I can confirm that the locals aren't welcoming and don't want you there. Subsequent owners of the house have also changed the facade to remove the iconic windows and have also changed the address to deter would-be looky-loos. On the final day that the Lutzes were in the house, George and Kathy allege that they awoke in the morning with George getting out of bed. When he turned around and looked back at Kathy, her face was that of an extremely aged old woman, very creased and wrinkly, with sunken eyes and tight lips. As George stated, quote-unquote, Kathy looked like an old crag version of herself. Indeed, Kathy said she looked in the mirror and her face looked like a Halloween mask, and stayed that way for several hours. When it happened, Kathy said that she was without energy and could barely get up or walk and move around. George and Kathy had reached their limit and were also fearful for what would happen to their family. The final straw came when George and Kathy were in their bedroom trying to understand what was happening to Kathy's face when they could hear tremendous banging coming from the room above theirs. This was the boys' bedroom. When George and Kathy investigated, they witnessed the boys' beds, with the boys in them, lifting off the floor and slamming back down, while their bedroom and closet doors opened and slammed shut repeatedly. The Lutz family, along with their dog Harry, fled the house at 4 p.m. on January the 14th, 1976. They left all of their possessions, their boat, vehicles, food and furniture, and headed eventually to Kathy's mother's house in nearby Deer Park, New York, after a stay for the first night at a local motel. They left on Father Ray's advice to protect the children. They later sent removal men to retrieve their items on April the 18th, Easter Sunday. The removal men reported no paranormal phenomena while inside the house, as have all subsequent owners of 112 Ocean Avenue. But there may be a reason for this. Thanks to the books and movies and all the bullshit that they had created about the Amityville story, it was widely peddled that the phenomenon was linked to the house. But the Lutzes claimed that in reality the phenomenon followed them. First to Kathy's mother's house, then on to San Diego, where they settled several months later. For clarity, the Lutz family moved to San Diego on May 9th, Mother's Day, 1976. George Lutz told Art Bell in 2002 that he gave his car away to the person at the airport check-in desk at JFK. They literally left everything behind and started all over again. Do you remember earlier when I spoke briefly about Kathy and George's practices with transcendental meditation? Well, as I said, whilst the couple spoke of their fondness for the practice, Christopher, their son, has since said that they actually conducted spiritual meditation, but George and Kathy didn't follow it in a positive way. They wanted fortune and material reward, so they sought the guidance of quote-unquote alternative spirits. George had dabbled in the occult for several years. He had spoken with Dr. Raymond Buckland. He had sought the darker practices and rituals of Gardnerian Wicca and Crowleyan magic. He called on the four prince spirits of the world. Now, these were not the spirits recommended by meditation yogis or Buddhist spiritualists. George summoned dark spirits and demons into himself, Christopher alleges. In addition, Christopher would say in 2021, quote, that what George was playing with in the basement of that house would have caused a haunting in any location. It was not the house, unquote. Just to clarify, for those of you who seek further information, the four prince spirits of the world are fire, which is Samael and Oriens, water, which is Azrael and Paimon, air, which is Azazel and Egin, and earth, which is Mahazel and Amaemon. The dual names refer to the same spirit or demon, but differ from traditional Hebrew texts of the latter Jewish magic book of rituals, Semiphorus, which wasn't written until 1686, though it referred to occult knowledge from centuries earlier. George, it is alleged, by his stepson, may have brought what happened in Amityville on the family himself. These are elements of the story which George and Kathy have never spoken about, though multiple sources who knew the Lutzes have confirmed George's interest in the occult and subsequent drawing of Kathy into similar practices. Epilogue. If you believe any of this at all. World-renowned paranormal investigator Hans Holzer read in the New York Times in February 1976 an article by reporter Pranay Gupta. It reported on the DeFeo murders, sentencing of Ronnie DeFeo, and the subsequent haunting of 112 Ocean Avenue. Holzer said that in that moment he knew from experience that in the moment of spirit possession, no sound will leave the location of the possessed. This is why, he proposed, no one heard the gunshots the night Ronnie DeFeo murdered his family. Ronnie DeFeo, Holzer said, must have been possessed by something evil from within the house. Holzer then visited DeFeo in prison and questioned him about his experiences in the Amityville house. Yes, things occasionally moved without human interference, Ronnie stated. And yes, there was always an eerie and negative atmosphere and feeling in the house. Ronnie also said that his mother Louise always said that the house was haunted and strange things happened there. But was this all bullshit? Was Ronnie telling Holzer what he wanted to hear? Holzer wanted to investigate the house for himself, and George Lutz was happy to facilitate this. In March 1976, Holzer, accompanied by a regular collaborator of his, the transmedium Ethel Johnson Myers, visited the house at 112 Ocean Avenue. Johnson Myers, Holzer alleges, knew nothing of where she was going or anything about the house or the murders. This can't be independently verified, of course. When Johnson Myers arrived at the house and exited the car, she instantly exclaimed that she felt evil energy from the house. She went further. The energy was of a vengeful Native American tribal chief or warrior. She felt his spirit was negative and wanted to gravely influence male energies on the land for evil deeds. Indeed, Holzer and George Lutz actually paid a visit to Seth Purdy, curator of the Amityville Historical Society, to inquire about the history of the land. Now, let's be clear about this from the start. The horror movie trope, which is essentially now a cliché where haunted houses are built on ancient Indian burial grounds, well, that all came from what happened in Amityville. Movies like Poltergeist, The Shining and Pet Sematary all lean into this trope, as does The Amityville Horror, written by Jay Anson. So, in reality, Holzer and George Lutz asked Seth Purdy about the history of the land, and he stated that Native Americans had hunted on the lands, but little more. He did, however, confirm that a newspaper article in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, reported on March 30, 1905, stated that during the construction of homes on Ocean Avenue, several bodies of Native Americans of the Iroquois tribe had been discovered, including the body of a powerful native chief who was buried standing up, as was tradition for respected leaders within their culture. The bodies had originally been found by neighborhood children, who removed the chief's head and played football with it. This level of disrespect, Holzer speculated, could have been the cause for evil and negativity in the Ocean Avenue house. Evil, waiting for the appropriate time when negativity was at its strongest to manifest an opportunity for demonic possession. Could this evil have laid dormant until Ronnie DeFeo manifested or awoke the energy on the land? Potentially continued by George and his occult dabbling? What are your thoughts? Fun fact, when Hans Holzer and Ethel Johnson Myers first investigated the Amityville house, they took a number of Polaroid photographs to document their visit. There are a number of those Polaroids which showed the bullet holes left from the murders that Ronnie DeFeo committed. Well, each of the bullet holes in the pictures glow bright orange with aura energy, Johnson Myers stated. The images are available online and have been verified to have not been doctored in any way. Search them out and take a look. Anyway, referring back to the Indian burial ground trope, the Amityville horror movie in Jay Anson's book quite disrespectfully stated that the land that the house had been built on was where native Shinnecock Americans abandoned their insane and also buried them there. This is grossly inaccurate and stinks of white settler guilt. In all actuality, the Shinnecock tribe actually cared for their mentally ill and didn't abandon them. Further, it wasn't tradition for their tribe to leave their dead in a cemetery or burial ground like current Western Christian tradition does now. As Native American tribes often moved around, their dead would often be buried where the death occurred, so a burial ground is entirely inaccurate. The Shinnecock tribe only hunted on what is modern-day Long Island, for the record, and never actually settled there. So, for transparency, in March 1976, Laura DeDeo, a news anchor for Channel 5 in New York, was tasked with putting together a television program about ghosts and hauntings. It was very in vogue at the time in the mid-1970s. She had just heard about the Amityville haunting, so she tracked down George Lutz. Him and his family were now staying at Kathy's mother's house in Deer Park. DeDeo asked Lutz if she may put together an investigative team to research the house at Ocean Avenue. George agreed. Within days, DeDeo had assembled a parapsychology team from Duke University, which included a number of well-known and respected psychics, mediums, and investigators of the time. Namely, Mary Pascarella. Pascarella was a psychic medium who ran a school in New England called the Psychical Research Institute. Mary actually provided the training and guidance for the Warrens. Pascarella worked with law enforcement solving cold cases for more than 20 years. Philosophy teacher and parapsychologist Dr. Alex Tanous. Tanous was a noted New England psychic and parapsychologist. He was a lecturer in parapsychology at the University of Southern Maine, a research participant and assistant for 20 years at the American Society for Psychical Research, and an international speaker in the media and in universities and colleges on parapsychology and well-being. Alberta Riley. Riley was a psychic medium from New England who graduated from the University of London with a PhD in physical chemistry. Riley was a practitioner of psychic visions, premonitions, and out-of-body events. She regularly predicted the deaths of individuals and eventually had to refrain from informing them. Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens were paranormal investigators and authors associated with prominent cases of alleged hauntings. Based in Monroe, Connecticut, but investigating phenomenon both nationally and internationally, the Warrens also founded the New England Society for Psychic Research, NESPA, the oldest ghost hunting group in New England. This team were accompanied by Laura DeDeo and Marvin Scott, news anchors for Channel 5, who were documenting the investigation. Mary Pascarella immediately sensed pure evil upon entering the Ocean Avenue house. As she was praying on the first floor outside what would have been Mark and John Matthew DeFeo's bedroom, she opened her eyes and witnessed a young boy appear with glowing white eyes before fading out of view entirely. Alberta Riley was so affected by the negative and abhorrent forces within the house that she had to leave the investigation early. Riley was deeply affected by what she felt in the house. Following the investigation at Amityville, Mary Pascarella retired her services as a psychic medium and never took part in paranormal research again. Lorraine Warren said of the house at Amityville, quote unquote, "This house is as close to hell as I ever want to get." A seance was held by the investigators and further claim was made to an evil Native American force being at the location, looking to possess those who would allow it. There were also a number of photographs taken at the scene, with a now infamous photograph of a young boy poking his head around a corner with eyes glowing white. This occurred outside what was Mark and John Matthew DeFeo's bedroom. Critics have said that the boy is the photographer that Ed and Lorraine Warren brought with them. Although, he was the one who shot the photograph. What are your thoughts? An interesting fact, when the parapsychology team was being assembled, the Lutz family friend, Carol Saviano, was asked to collect Dr. Alex Tanous from the airport and bring him to the house. On the hour-long drive from JFK, Carol felt that Tanous, a psychic, was trying to get inside her head and find out all she knew about the haunting. Carol stated that in her head, she pictured the words, "Stop it," in large glowing writing. Tanous turned to her in the car and apologized, saying that he will stop. A year after the Lutz family fled the house in Amityville, they were now residing in San Diego. The Amityville Horror book was written when their friend Carol contacted an editor at the publishing company, Prentice Hall, and made inquiries as to whether the Lutzes could write a book about their experiences. Subsequently, they were invited into their offices where George and Kathy Lutz were introduced to ghostwriter Jay Anson. The Lutzes did not work directly with Anson, but submitted around 45 hours of tape-recorded recollections to him. Anson then turned these recollections into the book, the profits of which the Lutzes would receive 50%. This evidence is why the book took so much liberty with the truth. Further, Anson never claimed that it was factually accurate. Neither did the Lutzes. They simply said what happened to them was fact, and the book is just based on that. The movie, which was made without the Lutz family direct involvement, took even further liberty with the truth. Following the release of The Amityville Horror, George and Kathy Lutz embarked on an overseas promotional speaking tour where they were interviewed in the UK, Europe, Australia and South Africa. George and Kathy placed their three children in a Catholic orphanage while they went away. While in London, England in 1977, George Lutz visited St. Saviour's Church in Hampstead. He specifically sought out the services of Reverend Christopher Neil Smith, well known as the Church of England's chief parapsychologist and exorcist. While in the company of Reverend Neil Smith, George underwent an exorcism to rid him of the demons he took with him to California. At the time, George was convinced that Christopher, his stepson, was also possessed and had extrasensory powers that he intended to use to harm George with his mind. In 2004, George took part in the planning of an Amityville Horror sequel, which would have culminated with the Christopher Lutz character killing George Lutz by using psychic powers of the mind. The movie didn't get made. Instead, a remake of the original was produced, starring Ryan Reynolds as George Lutz. George and Kathy Lutz divorced in 1988, but remained on good terms. Christopher, Danny and Missy chose to have little involvement with George following the divorce. Christopher changed his name back to Christopher Quarantino, his birth father's surname. George actually sued Christopher in 2004 after Christopher purchased the rights to AmityvilleHorror.com to prevent George from obtaining it. Kathy Lutz died on August the 17th, 2004. She was 57 years of age. George Lutz died on May the 8th, 2006. He was 59 years of age. Danny and Christopher remain staunch in their knowledge that what happened at 112 Ocean Avenue was true paranormal phenomenon. Missy Lutz has avoided the public eye. In 2022, the annulment document 73/161 for George Lutz's first marriage was uncovered and revealed to the public for the first time. Within the document, George's first wife alleges spousal abuse from George, both physical and mental. George signed the document in acceptance of the writ within. As part of the documentation, a therapist letter by a Dr. Francis C. Bauer, who had been treating George Lutz at the time of his first divorce, confirmed that George Lutz's callousness and psychotic behavior was due to him suffering with serious personality disorders, including antisocial personality disorder. What do you think is the truth to the Amityville Horror?
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.